Welcome, my friends. This is Pastor Butch Paul. I'm filling in for Melody Siege someday. He took the afternoon off. This is Financial Survival, and I hope y'all are going to enjoy this 20 minutes with me today. The next two segments will be with Melody, of course, and James Corbett and Melody will be together sharing their thoughts for the last two segments. You and I for the first 20 minutes, if you don't mind. And again, welcome to the program. And this is Financial Survival. Melody's here. She's taking the afternoon off, and good for her. And don't forget to call her. You know, I don't know what else we can say or do to get people to understand the importance of protecting yourself financially. I don't know what else to do. Melody's been trying for years, and of course, my little radio show, a little ministry show, I try to explain the importance of sound financial planning as the Bible teaches. But you call Melody at 800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. Ask questions about what you can do to plan for your future. Now, I'm going to try to do what she does as far as markets, folks. Now, I'm not Melody's Houston, and I'm not the expert that she is, but I'll do what I can. The Dow was down today, 210 points, down to 26,815. The NASDAQ was down 59 points to 8,097. Mine's going to blank here. The 10-year yield, 1.75. Oil was down 9 cents, 53.75. Gold was up a few cents, 14.94.50. I'm sorry, I did not get the silver account up quick enough, and I'm so sorry. But I just didn't get up in time. That's my fault. But nonetheless, gold, folks, let me make this point. It's 14.94.50. Still at $1,500 roughly. This is my opinion only. I don't think you're going to see gold go much lower than that. But if it does drop, if it goes down to 500, man, jump on both feet. Now's the time to buy. It will never go to nothing. You've always got something there that you can count on when things really get rough. I've done it. I've done it in the past, and I probably do it in the future. I still believe that what I've done over the last 20-some years is what got my wife and I ready for some kind of semi-retirement. Took care of a couple of surgeries on my son and paid cash for it, folks. That doesn't happen very often, does it? Because of people like Melody Seastrom. Again, Melody Seastrom's number is 800-375-4188. And I got this headline in, and we'll read it to you from Melody because it's, you know, there's always a lot of financial news out there, a lot of financial news, and I am not as good at gathering together as Melody is, but I do what I can with news headlines that I think affect all of us in every way, including financial. But it says, this is out of Reuters, Wall Street fell on Friday as negative headlines about Johnson & Johnson and Boeing and bleak economic data from China soared investor risk appetite, offsetting generally positive corporate earnings. Boeing dropped 4.8% after Reuters reported that text messages between two employees suggested the plane maker misled the Federal Aviation Administration about the safety of the grounded 737 MAX aircraft. Johnson & Johnson announced it would recall baby powder in the United States after regulators found trace amounts of asbestos in a sample, sending its shares falling 5.6%. You know, I got to make a comment here. Johnson's baby powder. Johnson's & Johnson. That was a name that went along with babies. Who would have thought that the baby powder and talcum powder would cause cancer? I don't know if they knew it or not. I can't say either way, but that's something. Growth of China's gross domestic product slowed to its weakest pace in 30 years as a bruising trade war with the United States took its toll, stroking fears of slowdown contagion. The International Monetary Fund has lowered its forecast for global growth this year to 3%, which would mark the slowest expansion since the financial crisis. Again, that keeps coming up, doesn't it? Financial crisis, 2008. That's it keeps coming up and being brought up in about every topic because, obviously, it's important. It was a standard set back then, and it's comparing to the same time today. Analysts see the S&P 500 earnings dropping by 3.1% compared with last year, which would mark the first contraction since the earnings recession that ended in mid-2016. So reports are showing that even under the Trump administration, manufacturing sales and production are shrinking. I don't know enough to say whether that's going to be a lasting thing or not. But I do know that we're seeing the economy falter in a lot of different ways, in ways that I think it should concern anybody out there that has a plan to retire sometime in the next 5, 10 years or longer. You know, you have to think ahead, folks, in the future. If the dollar still uses as a meme exchange has come to 10 years from now, and it's fallen every day in value, what will you have to retire on? How much less will your dollar buy in 2030 than it does in 2020? You need to think about those things and plan for that in the future. You truly do. Now, we have some good news. Louisiana could be the first state without abortion access as soon as next year. Louisiana, bless their heart, could be the first state to stop murdering babies. Louisiana could become the first state not to have legal abortion access since a procedure was legalized in 1973. Depending on the outcome of the upcoming Supreme Court case next spring, the state could see abortion access effectively eliminated, even though Roe v. Wade, the case that legalized the procedure, would stay intact. Good for Louisiana. Louisiana's Unsafe Abortion Protection Act is at the heart of the Supreme Court case. The law, not currently in effect, could require doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Supporters of the law say the regulation would assist with continuity of care in the event of an emergency. Good for them. Wonderful news. And now people say, well, what's that have to do with finances? Well, folks, the blood money is all about finances. Planned Parenthood and all people that work there, many, many murder doctors have become wealthy from the innocent blood of unborn babies. It's all about the dollar. And on top of that, a righteous God judges a nation that murders its unborn, a sacrifice of the children to Baal, so to speak. And it does affect all of us in every way possible, including financially. Canadian Central Bank exploring digital currency. Now, pay attention. This is important. Canadian Central Bank exploring digital currency to better track people's spending habits. Uh-huh. Should have known that'd be part of it, shouldn't you? Of course, they want to do that so they can tax the cryptocurrencies a little more effectively. It's called the document titled Central Bank Money, the Next Generation, was reportedly prepared for the current governor of the Bank of Canada. Now, so folks, how much clearer can they make this? They want to go to digital money, not because it's necessarily better, because it's nothing but a glitch on a computer. It's a little 0-1 on a computer is all it is. But it's to track people's spending habits. As you've already heard in Australia, The slogan now is cash is for criminals. Does that concern you at all, or is this something we just need to ignore and move on? I mean, does it bother you that we're heading down the road of the biblical idea of the mark of the beast, where everything you purchase and sell will be tracked and monitored? And without the proper ID, that's what the mark of the beast is, you won't be able to buy or sell without it. Can you see a picture being formed here, if you will, of a plan to bring all this about in a way to monitor people 24/7, everything they do, everything they say, everywhere they go? Surely that makes you have to stop and think about this. Cash is still a little bit of privacy, folks. I can take a $200 somewhere and pick up a nice used gun somewhere, a hunting rifle, or hey, an AK, whatever. It's my business. It's my gun. And I can do that and do it anonymously. But when cash is done away with, that will be done away with also. So for all you that are excited about using your iPhones to pay for your bills and to do all your shopping and using debit cards and credit cards to do all your shopping, you are cutting your own throat to your privacy. Now, most people do that, don't really care, though. They don't really care. If it's convenient, they'll do it. They don't care what the results of it are. If it's convenient, they will do what they have to for convenience sake. That's the mindset of the country in America, and that's the way it is. So, take what you want to believe. Is Putin the new king of the Middle East? Russia assumes mantle of supreme power broker in the Middle East, proclaimed Britain's Telegraph. Russia's status as an undisputed power broker in the Middle East was cemented as Vladimir Putin continued to a triumphant tour of capitals traditionally allied to the U.S. Donald Trump has handed Putin the Middle East on a plate, was the title of a Telegraph column. Putin seizes on Trump's Syria retreat to cement Middle East role, said the Financial Times. Folks, I am 120% against meddling in foreign affairs. I truly am. Sovereign nations do not need our approval or disapproval of anything they're doing internally. And it should be the same for us. And all nations who become the policemen of the world, or we'll call them empires, eventually crumble under their own weight. I totally agree we should get our troops out of 100-some countries right now and bring them here and build our own defenses. But to pull out and leave an ally like that you've been working with for years, offering some semblance of peace and normalcy to their lives, and turned over to another country, in my opinion, was a bad move on Trump. I don't know what his real reasons are. I guess we won't know till later on when everything comes out, because I can't read his mind. But Turkey certainly took advantage of it. Putin stepped in and said, let's end it. Let's stop this. So Russia now is basically the controller of Middle East peace and probably soon their finances and oil. Yeah, I said oil. We will see. Unprecedented movement detected on California earthquake fault capable of an 8.0 tremor. A major California fault capable of producing a magnitude of 8.0 earthquake had begun moving for the first time on record, a result of this year's Ridgecrest earthquake sequence destabilizing nearby faults. Caltech scientists say that a new study released in the Journal of Science on Thursday. In the modern historical record, the 160-mile long Karlak fault on the northern edge of the Mojave Desert has never been observed to have produced either a strong earthquake or even to creep. The slow movement between earthquakes that causes a visible scar on the ground surface. But new satellite radar images now show that the fault has started to move, causing a bulging of land that can be viewed from space. This is surprising because we've never seen the Karlak fault do anything. Here, all of a sudden, it's changed its behavior, said the lead author of the study, Zachary Ross, assistant professor of geophysics at Caltech. We don't know what this means. Well, Pennsylvania, which is supposed to be the most stable place in the country against earthquakes because of the soil makeup, had an earthquake a couple days ago, 2-point-something, enough to rattle people. It's had even shook people out of their beds. I don't know all the details on that. But it's the first one ever recorded in Pennsylvania. The most stable geological place in North America. It had an earthquake. And again, folks, I go back to what my Father in Heaven says and what Christ said in Matthew 24. Earthquakes in diverse places. Which doesn't just mean different places. It means also new places. You just heard in California that's the first time it's ever had any sign of any movement on that fault. And now it is actually happening. And it could produce a capable of 8.0, which is really unbelievably huge. Hong Kong volunteers document extreme police brutality, urge journalists to help. A Hong Kong group called Net Citizens Organizing Police Abuse Investigation Data, NOPAD, this week published an extensive report on the excessive use of force by police against protesters. The report concluded that thorough reforms of the Hong Kong police force are needed far beyond the sort of independent investigation long demanded by the protest movement. I don't know all the ins and outs. I thought when it started 4 or 5 months ago that when it got their way about not being having to be taken out of the country for trial to China, when that law was taken away, I thought this might settle down, but it didn't. It's kept on going. And it's caused, I'm sure, a lot of harassment and embarrassment for the Chinese government. I'm sure it has. It's caused a lot of unease, and I don't know where it's going to end. Do I think China's going to just bow out and let it happen and keep on going on? No, I don't think so. But I don't know. I just don't know. Now listen to this next article. We've been hearing for years about we got to save the planet, all global warming, climate change, all this. And even NASA itself says it isn't happening. But do you hear ABC or CBS say anything about that? Of course not. Hundreds of scientists say it's all made up. It's not happening. I'm telling the truth. Check it out for yourself. It says Extinction Rebellion climate activist paid over $500 per week by George Soros to shut down the airport and whatever in London. In the past week, over 1,300 arrests were made involving members of the Extinction Rebellion, a climate change alarmist group that is critical of the West and has blocked roads and shut down the London airport. George Soros is among the high-profile donors to the group. The Mail on Sunday revealed documents showing that the activists have been paid, now pay attention, over $88,000 during a four-month span and more than $253,000 since the founding of the group. Extinction Rebellion's finances have come under scrutiny as the group has paid no taxes on the money it has paid to its activist members. These so-called activists are paid actors. You don't have to pay people to support a cause in which they truly believe. It's all political theater, folks. Now that is a fact. George Soros is one of the huge backers of this so-called climate change rebellion. The sad part is our youth have been duped right into believing it. They truly have. Our youth has been duped, conned, brainwashed into believing a lie. And they're the ones that are going to be taking over the country real soon. Many of them will be voting in this upcoming election. And they are going to be the final, I think, in probably my lifetime, the final push to take us into a total communist system. Yeah, I do believe that. We're going to see a lot of things happen soon under Agenda 2030 with the sustainable communities that they want to develop, get people off the out of the country and in cities and contain them as animals so they won't pollute the world. Matter of fact, it's got so bad now that in Norway, they're asking people not to use the toilet in the morning, pee in the shower. I'm serious. Don't flush the toilet. Too much water being used. Pee in the shower. This is all for real stuff, people. It really is. About ready to run out of time today, and I hope you didn't mind me being with you for a little bit today. Hang on. James Corbett's coming up with Melody Seastrom, and they're going to do this will be a rebroadcast from last night. I think you're going to enjoy it. I will see you next week myself on Tuesday afternoon with Melody. Have a wonderful weekend. Give her a call at 800-375-4188.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and yes, I am very pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And just to share with you, we know that James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report. It was founded in 2007, and in 2012, he became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And, of course, we all know the International Forecaster was created by our friend Bob Chapman. You can visit James's website at thecorbettreport.com, and you can also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Good afternoon, James.
Almost. Good morning.
Good morning. Good evening. we're going to get all the time zones here. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well, and yes, thank you to all those people who did write in with their concern, but the recent typhoon/earthquake was nowhere near us and our family home here on the western side of Japan, so thankfully we were completely spared from all of that.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. How did you know that was going to be my first question to you? So,
just a hunch. It's what everyone's been asking about the last several days.
How does the government respond to crisis? I don't know if it'd be any different from how our government responds, or is it at very political, like sometimes ours is, if they don't respond as quickly as they should and so forth, or is it just people used to?
I think anywhere around the world there's always going to be politics that come into play with disaster response and what have you, and Japan is no different. For example, of course, in the wake of the Fukushima disaster, as we now know, they not only covered up the fact that they knew that the three reactors had complete meltdowns, but they actually took the radiation monitoring network that had been set up specifically to detect and follow the fallout from any nuclear emergency. They took that offline, or at least did not give that information to journalists, to the public, for I believe it was 1, maybe 2 months after the incident itself took place, which would have shown Tokyo, amongst other heavily populated areas, in the path of the fallout in the days directly in the wake of that emergency. So there's those types of incidents. Also, the big Kobe earthquake, the Hanshin earthquake of I believe it was 1996 or thereabouts, in the 1990s before I got here. That earthquake is somewhat famous for the fact that the most efficient and most thoroughgoing response was not from the government; it was from the Japanese mafia, who stepped in and helped out and provided water and aid to people and things like that, which is, I think, obviously part of the Japanese mafia's front. We're here for the people. You know, we can provide even when the government can't, which there may be some truth to it, but then again, how separate is the mafia from the government? They're definitely related and interlinked. So, and I don't even mean that metaphorically. I mean, really, the government plays along with the mafia and the mafia plays along with the government. So there's always politics when it comes into disaster response. But on the whole, unless it is that type of situation where they don't want the entire country to freak out, like in the wake of Fukushima, on the whole, I mean, people will get aid and there will be a response. But, you know, as always, is it enough? And what will ultimately become of those people whose lives have been affected by those types of emergencies? Which, let us remind ourselves, is not an uncommon thing here in Japan. Just last year, as you might remember, it was all around us where we live in western Japan. There was huge, unprecedented flooding taking place. There's always volcanoes or earthquakes or typhoons or something going on here.
You know, I found it interesting when you said the Japanese mafia. You know, when I think of mafia, I think of the Italians, the United States, Italy, and, you know, and Russia. You hear Russian mafia, but not Japanese. And I just find that kind of interesting. And of course, one question I had later on in the program, we were talking, I was going to ask you about President Trump, questions about him and the taxes. And, you know, he's sort of like, you know, they're after his taxes, almost like Al Capone, which was a gangster in our time during the Depression, in which he had the soup lines to feed people that, you know, were going exactly. hungry. So, you know, so
yeah,
they,
and so a very similar thing over here in the Japanese mafia, the Yakuza, as they're called, again, have a reputation. It's interesting. It's actually one of those things that tells you something about Japan and Japanese society itself, is that in the Japanese mindset, you're going to have crime. So it might as well be organized crime, you know, as long as it's you know, controllable in that sense. At least we know, okay, well, the mafia plays by certain rules, and they generally will only go after you if you've messed with them, kind of thing. Then they'll keep the streets relatively safe. So, hey, we might as well go that route. And so the Japanese police actively cooperate with the Japanese mafia here, and they do these under-the-table arrangements and such things, where the police chief will visit the Yakuza family crime boss, and the crime boss will leave the membership list in the garbage can as he goes out to, you know, out of the room for a minute, and of course the policeman fishes it out, and, you know, it's all that kind of under-the-table arrangement where there's always a wink and a nod, and it's not like the Japanese police and the government doesn't know that this is operating, but at least it's contained to a certain extent, so they allow it to happen.
We know today we were given the image of Kim Jong-un riding a white horse up a sacred mountain. And, of course, his deadline for U.S. movement on the nuclear talks is coming to is nearing. And so as a result of these images, South Korean media are speculating that Kim may be considering perhaps a new strategy with his dealings with the U.S. Is that just trying to get his name back into the headlines, or did it have any meaning? Did you see the picture? Did you see any comments, or would you like to comment on that?
I'm just looking at the comments now. A lot of them kind of pithy comments from the internet crowd. But, you know, whether this is a signal or what it's meant to tell us about the policy decisions of the North Korean government, I mean, it speaks in and of itself, the fact that people are talking so much about a single photo like this, as if it really is something that we should be scrying the tea leaves, trying to read in a way. It speaks to the secrecy of the Hermit Kingdom, the presumably the most sheltered country on the face of the planet, with the walls of secrecy up around it. So I'm not going to speculate myself what this image is meant to mean and whether it has some great policy implications, but I think just the fact that people are speculating on that tells us a lot about how sequestered North Korea is and how difficult it is to understand what's going on in that country.
I'm sure you know that President Donald Trump has removed troops out of Syria on Wednesday. Donald Trump seemed to wash his hands of this conflict between Turkey and America's Kurdish allies in Syria. That, in turn, it generated some intense criticism from, you know, the typical Republican allies. They joined the Democrats, rebuked him. The day ended with a heated confrontation between Trump and the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I know there's myself, we want our troops to come home. Was this a right move for Donald Trump?
It's interesting. I'm not overall a fan of Donald Trump or any other politician, but he has always seemed to have the right instincts on Syria specifically. Certainly that's what he was campaigning on. Why are we in Syria? It's a waste of our money. Whatever that kind of line of reasoning is, I think it's the wrong line of reasoning on moral grounds. I think really there is a moral reason why the U.S. empire should not be invested everywhere around the world and slaughtering people on other sides of the planet. But hey, whatever reason is given for withdrawing, I think is a good enough reason to get the troops out of there. But of course, embedded in all of these, in Afghanistan and Syria and everywhere else that the American empire is currently extended, there's always that narrative that's embedded in there that if we leave, everything will turn into hell in a handbasket, and you know it will be your fault, Mr. President, for taking us out of there. So that's always the booby trap in these situations, and I think that's the sort of sword of Damocles that's been dangled over Trump's head since he started, since he got into office and started potentially sort of tiptoeing towards trying to get this withdrawal implemented, and has failed spectacularly in doing that until we see this withdrawal of sorts that's taken place over the past week or two, and of course immediately descends into chaos. Again, I think that's kind of the booby trap that's implanted here, but here's one way of looking at this. We're talking about Turkey attacking Kurds in northern Syria, and this is because the U.S. was withdrawing. And how does the mainstream media respond to this? Well, for example, the New York Times has had a number of editorials or news, quote-unquote, articles or overview articles asking, for example, why is Turkey fighting the Kurds in Syria? Or who are the Kurds and why is Turkey attacking them in Syria? These are actual headlines from the New York Times. It should give us pause for thought that, well, okay, yes, the average American probably does not know who are the Kurds and why Turkey is attacking them in Syria and things like this, but this is precisely why it is none of the U.S.'s business or national security interest or vital reason we must be over there to stop the Turks from attacking the Kurds. What on earth does that have to do with the fundamental principles that were pronounced, at least at the founding of the United States and by the founding fathers, that we will have alliance, or we will have a trade with all, but a tangling alliances with none. We don't want to be involved in Europe's politics. Well, why on earth is the U.S. so central to what's happening in the Middle East, and they have to be the ones between the Kurds and the Turks in Syria and against Assad and all of this, when the average American, rightfully so, would look to the New York Times and say, well, who are the Kurds and why is Turkey attacking them? And what does that have to do with the price of tea in Kentucky? I mean, that's really the point here. And I think it goes to the more fundamental point that this is the logic of interventionism. They like to call people who do not think that the U.S. military empire should be extended everywhere in the world isolationists, as if it's isolationist to want to protect your own country and its own borders rather than be halfway around the world fighting in some war that makes no sense for people you don't know, that you don't understand the situation. But in fact, it's the exact opposite. You're not isolationist for thinking that. You're a non-interventionist. It's the interventionists who think it is the American military's job to be policemen all around the world. So here's the thing. When and if these withdrawals happen, in Syria, in Afghanistan, elsewhere, there will be chaos, because there was chaos before. There is chaos ongoing now. It's just that it's in the mainstream media's interests to point it out to the public now. Now they can say, oh, look at the chaos that's taking place over there. It's all because we've removed our troops from over there, which is just, it's like starting the clock at 11:59 p.m. and then saying that that's what created the entire day's events. It's ludicrous. Hmm.
That's a very good way to put it, because, you know, the timing is everything to me. And, you know, it's, of course, we're heading to there, you know, he's going into the election next year, and you don't know if it's all part of a campaign. You know, he wants to support the campaign promise and so forth. And if it's true, you have the players of, you know, Russia are to benefit, Iran's to benefit from us pulling out. And then on the other hand, we're trying to put all the sanctions we can on Iran and so forth. So if this benefited, you know, Iran to some degree, you know, it does become very confusing on not just for us trying to figure it out, but to make decisions. Mm-hmm. I can imagine President Trump's, you know, I mean, of course, they have more knowledge than we do.
It is a catch-22. It is a bind.
It is.
Because there's no easy way to withdraw, and it's not going to be perfect when you withdraw. Not everyone's going to be happy and get along, and there is going to be violence and chaos. But there's going to be violence and chaos in the long run either way. That's the important point. And it's a point that was made quite aptly by Dick Cheney back in the 1990s after Gulf War I. He said we couldn't just continue going on and overthrow Saddam and all of that at that point, because that was – ultimately that would work in Iran's interest to overthrow Saddam. So, we don't want to start interfering with things like that. And of course, he was saying that just to cover the Bush regime, Bush senior regime, and what they were doing after Gulf War I. But it's equally true, in fact, even more so with Gulf War II, with Bush Jr., that, as we now know, has played into Iran's hand, and it has made Iran a stronger presence in the region. Yeah. And now they're, look, Iran's a big menace. So now we have to further interfere in Syria to make sure that Iran isn't, and it is the logic. It just keeps growing and growing. And not only can you not withdraw, you have to start sending more and more troops to occupy more and more regions to fix the problem that you created by going in there in the first place. And until the American public really realizes and internalizes that and understands that this is not something that you can continue, that will be won just by having troops over there. In fact, it will require more and more over longer and longer periods of time. Until the public really understands that, I don't think there will be a change, because politicians are as fickle as the public that votes or doesn't vote for them.
In a recent article that appeared in your Corbett Report newsletter, is entitled "The World's Largest Democratic Biometric Prison," you criticize certain establishment observers like Thomas Friedman, who believe that India, with its growing economic might and vibrant functional parliamentary system, can provide a freedom-respecting alternative to the Chinese communist model for economic development and industrialization. You say that the pundits are, as usual, half right. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm pointing out that actually, yes, I think India is being held up and being used as a model or a testing ground for the way that the developing countries around the world can develop and industrialize. But, and this is where the pundits are half wrong, but is it some sort of model that we should be holding up as some shining example? You know, this is the counter to the Chinese development model that has to do with freedom and liberty and respecting human rights or anything of that sort. No, quite the contrary. It is a nightmare biometric prison that is being erected right now in India and has been really ramping up for the last several years as it embarked on the largest biometric database in human history, over 1 billion people getting iris scanned and fingerprinted, and that being turned into a numerical ID that is now being linked to people's tax forms and everything else. It is the biometric nightmare that has been warned about for many, many years. It is happening now in India, and it is coming to, well, America and everywhere else around the world.
India would be the last place that I would have thought would take on such a huge, you just don't think that they're that far advanced. You know, it surprised me when I was reading this that they are doing it to the scale of that they're doing and their ability to do so. It's very interesting. And with that, we're going to be heading into a break right now. That's kind of interesting. And we'll be right back right after a few short messages.
Oh, don't you tell me again.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett. And heading into the break, we were talking about the biometric system, the greatest databases to ever be created, I guess. And my question is, why India, James? Why
good
is
question.
This?
Yeah. And you express the puzzlement that I'm sure a lot of people have, is that, well, why is this happening in a country that's so vast and so generally poor and so not you don't think of it as being technologically advanced. Also, I mean, it is famous for its ridiculous, horrible bureaucracy, a remnant of the British colonization. So why is it happening there? And I think it's one of those paradoxes that I could even relate to in my experience here in Japan. With regards specifically, I've noted many times, I've had cause to note many times on my podcast in the last decade or so, that one of the great things about living in Japan is it is a very cash-centric society. It is still by far the most common form of payment for everything, from a stick of bubble gum all the way up to cars. Cars are often purchased in cash. You go to the bank and withdraw that amount of cash and go into, I mean, it's very, very different from what I remember back in Canada, and I'm sure they're in the States. But I've always noted, it is at this point, cash is still very definitely king here in Japan, but I think Japan will be one of the first countries to make that switch and to flip over to cashless completely. I mean, I think that will be in the cards here, and I've noted that for a long time, and lo and behold, just recently we had a consumption tax increase here from 8% to 10%, and as part of the kind of the various hype and things surrounding this, one of the things that the government is trying to do is to incentivize people to start using cashless payment. And hey, here's an incentive. You can save 5% on your taxes or whatever it is if you use the cashless payment method at the store rather than cash. And I'm starting to see the beginnings of that campaign kicking off here. And it wouldn't surprise me if in a year or two, cashless is king over here and people are all on various cards. I think that's the way that it's heading, and I think that, again, it isn't surprising because I think of the way that Japanese society is, it can be easily steered by social engineers one way or another. And I think similarly in India, it's precisely because this is such a vast and such a mishmash of different bureaucracies and muddlement that they can come in and say, look, we're clearing the slate. We have this technology here that we can go to every village and every place in all of India, and we can thumbprint you and iris scan you and get that all in this electronic database. And here you go. Here's your number. And of course, as you would expect, with the largest database in the world, the largest biometric database at any rate, comes the largest security concerns and security risks, especially when it is tied into a government form of ID that is now mandated for taxes and other things. The security risk of that database is multiplied many times. And guess what? This database is not even, I think, 100% complete yet. I don't think they've enrolled everyone yet, but it has already been breached. And there's been reports about this, that there's been hacks into the database. But don't worry, we've just exposed over a billion people to potential identity theft, but don't worry. I mean, just keep enrolling, keep using it, and we'll more and more integrate it into cashless payments and other such things. So this is the nightmare scenario. And as I say, it's being tested out right now in India and on the largest scale imaginable. I mean, no country will be able to say, well, we can't do that. We have too many people. Well, this is the largest democratic nation in the world, and they're doing it, so you have no excuse. And I think that's the kind of model that India is going to be providing in this grand experiment. But I also talk about how it's tied into the electoral politics and other things going on in India. For example, there's the Indian provinces, Assam, has a problem with migration from Bangladesh, and that's been a source of political conflict and strife for decades now. You know, these people are migrants, and they're not really Indian. You know, it has to do with the Muslim-Hindu conflict and other such things, and it did result in a pogrom in the 1980s that, well, killed hundreds or thousands, depending on which source you read, of Muslim migrants. And at that time, the Indian government said, okay, we're going to do a mass citizenship check and make sure who is Indian and who is a migrant. We're going to kick out all the migrants. Don't worry. Well, that languished for decades. Now it's being pulled out of the bag by Modi, Prime Minister Modi, and his Hindu nationalist BJP party, that he's riding this big nationalist wave of populist support. And it's becoming a, you know, Hindu versus Muslim type of narrative playing out in Indian politics. So now they're bringing this out to say, okay, now we're going to do this mass citizenship check. And lots of people who were born in and have lived their entire lives in India are now being declared, well, you're not on the list. You're not a citizen. So we're going to put you in prison and then process your paperwork and ship you out. And they will literally be stateless people because they don't have any other identification from anyone else from any other country, because they've never lived in any other country. So it is becoming a nightmare scenario. But don't worry, there's a response to that. Well, why don't we just link up this citizenship database with the Aadhaar, the biometric database, so that we can make sure that everyone is in this database, and we can then differentiate, okay, this is a migrant, this is a citizen. And once we link the two together, then all the problems will be solved for all time, because everyone will be in that database electronically. There will be no doubt. You just have to fingerprint or iris scan anytime you want to interact in any way in the Indian economy, and we'll make sure that you're a real, authentic Indian citizen. And again, that is the model for the United States and everywhere else around the world. It will happen if the social engineers get their way. There will be thumbprints or fingerprints to get online and to transact and interact and everything else you can think of. This is the way things are heading, unless we somehow find a way to put the brakes on it. But most people aren't even aware that this is happening.
Didn't Modi try to take the cash out of the system to some degree? Wasn't it that the black money, and they had a hard time, and it didn't really work, that they couldn't remove as much cash as they wanted to from the economy?
Right. I did do some reports on that at the time, so I will ask people to go to corporatereport.com and look that up. That was the demonetization that took place of certain notes in the Indian currency, specifically large denominations. They demonetized them, basically made them worthless overnight, saying, hey, you guys aren't going to be able to use these anymore, and you'll have to use these new notes that we're going to issue. And the whole point was to get everyone to take all the notes that they'd been storing under their mattress, or the equivalent thereof, and outside of the purview of the Indian tax office, of course, and they'd have to bring it in and change it for the new notes, and thus declare it, and all of the money would be on the table again, or in the books. And that was the whole point of that. Well, that was one important point of that, but another aspect of that I did cover at the time was that also incentivized these various cashless payment systems that were struggling for market space at that time, started to take off and become quite popular in the wake of that. So, you know, you don't have to worry about these cash things, and they're demonetizing what denomination today? Ah, who cares? I've got it all cashless anyway, so it's all legit and it's all there, and I don't have to worry about it. And so there, we did see a takeoff in cashless payment systems in India in the wake of that. And in fact, we saw Bill Gates and others were pimping that whole demonetization experiment that took place at the time, presumably because Bill Gates and others are very heavily invested in this technocratic idea of making everything cashless. So there's so many different tentacles to this octopus, but it's the same octopus, and it's ultimately all about control and taxation, but, you know, two sides of the same coin.
And I can't imagine how it could be any different. I mean, it's like there's no turning back. I mean, these systems are going to complete themselves.
It is almost unfathomable at this point. There is a certain there is a certain drive to this what would it even look like to put the brakes on this? I like to think that there will be people who will understand the need and the importance of cash, of a system that is not 100% physically trackable and traceable and databaseable in real time so that everything you ever do is recorded for all time. I would like to think people at least recognize the need for that, but I do wonder. And I was just listening to a podcast today by Stefan Kinsella, who is a great legal thinker and libertarian scholar, and he talks about intellectual property and other such things. He was talking about Bitcoin and what does it mean to own Bitcoin, and no one really owns a Bitcoin, and he was talking about the legal theory about that. And he made an interesting statement. He said, an alien examining our culture, or someone 2,000 years from now examining our current period of history, will find it mind-boggling. I mean, of course, we are going cashless. It is going to happen. Cash will go the way of the dodo. And he seemed very certain about that. I'd like to think there is some remnant out there of people who at least understand that the need to at least preserve that. And yes, maybe cashless will become 99.9% of the economy, but to at least preserve the idea of something that isn't electronically trackable and traceable. But I do wonder. I mean,
well, which would actually be gold, though. I mean, that's what it would be.
Well, yes, exactly. Something physical, something tangible, gold. Something tradable.
Yeah, right.
And silver and other precious metals. Yes, those will remain. I'd like to think so anyway. And it will be, a fringe part of the economy, I'm sure. But at any rate, there will be a market for it. And I think there always will be. I think that need will always exist. It's only a question of whether it is allowed to us, quote-unquote, by our political masters, quote-unquote.
Well, talking about, Bitcoin, China is beginning to introduce its own digital currency, and that was the big headlines earlier this week, and it's, where the government and the central banks, to see what people spend their money on. I believe that they can only remove, it's my understanding that they can only remove $50,000 from China, and they've been using Bitcoin going through various parts of the world to remove their wealth from China. This would kind of put a kibosh on that if China had its own e-cash system that would be, tightly regulated and run by the People's Bank of China. Yeah. So it's another step into what you've just were sharing with the listeners.
Yes, and these types of stories always, I mean, it's very frustrating for me because of the language that is employed to describe these types of things. A lot of the headlines will mention that this is China's cryptocurrency or something like that. Of course, it isn't a cryptocurrency. It will not be anonymous. There will be nothing really at the core of what something like Bitcoin at least was intended to be by the white paper. I mean, of course, has it ever lived up to that? Not really. Could it ever live up to that? Maybe, if people really cared about the anonymity and other aspects of it. But at any rate, whatever you want to call this new Chinese system, it is not going to be a cryptocurrency. And e-cash, again, what does that mean? Cash is something that's physical and tradable and isn't electronically itemized at the point of sale, etc. E-cash is the exact opposite of all that. It is not physical, and it will be itemized in database. So, again, all of the language that's employed is meant to confuse people. Essentially, what this is... Yeah, I mean, this is the complete government takeover of every transaction whatsoever in the economy, to the point where they can turn your ability to pay in that economy on or off. And that is essentially, China is right at that point anyway, given that the most commonly used form of payment in China right now are the WeChat or Alipay phone apps, which people have to download, and which, oh, by the way, the various, most popular Chinese apps are now being discovered. Who would have thunk it? Oh, it has backdoors so that the Chinese government can spy on everything you're doing on your phone. Wow, surprise, surprise. And yes, of course, WeChat and Alipay and everything else is going to be embedded in that ecosystem as well. So this is the complete control, the takeover of every aspect of our lives, and it is happening right before our eyes. And people are not burning their phones or throwing them in the river or Not that you should do that. It's probably quite toxic. But at any rate, they're not getting rid of these surveillance devices. They're embracing them even tighter. And it's, in fact, something that I just covered, just recorded my New World Next Week podcast with James Evan Pilato. We just recorded that today. And one of the stories is about more and more people, more and more couples, up to 93% saying they sleep with their phone at arm's length, which, of course, is not only interfering in their personal relationships as couples, but also is really the sign, if any were needed, that these digital devices are now so tightly interwoven in most people's lives that they couldn't imagine getting rid of them. And this is control. This is how the control will be manifested. And I'd like to think people, perhaps of an older generation like myself, I won't say like yourself.
I'm no, sure I was going to say speak for yourself.
You're 22 years old.
Right.
But
39.
But people who are old enough to remember the time before this will always, I'd like to think, at least have a memory of, well, maybe this isn't necessary. Maybe this is wrong or creepy. But our children and our children's children and et cetera, at some point it will be completely normalized. And that is the scariest idea of all.
It truly is. And when you see the youth today just embrace this, how they are fascinated, how it's, you know, they think it's exciting.
And yes, as we've pointed out before, the same tech giant moguls who created these very systems and software and devices are actively keeping their own children away from them. You'll find that in time after time. The founders of Facebook, the founders of Instagram, et cetera, they openly talk about, we don't let our children anywhere near screens until they're 10 years old or whatever it is, whereas most parents are doing the exact opposite and getting their children hooked on them very young because, hey, it's an easy way to babysit. It
truly is. It's frightening. It's and if they would only use it for the good. Isn't that funny? Anyway, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We're just about out of time, and I always enjoy having you on the program, and I get so many good comments. So, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you visit his website, thecorbettreport.com. And listeners, thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 800-375-4188. And Dave Allen will be joining me on Monday. So until then, have a good weekend, be safe, and God bless.